Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is Pat Prescott as we continue our Black History Month salute to individuals who are making waves in Southern California. We have one such individual with us in the studio today. He is a fourth-generation Angeleno, also fourth-generation theatrical. Very proud also to be in his fourth decade as an actor, producer, and director. That native Angeleno, a rare bird, something you don't see very often. Ren Brown is with us today, and we honor him today for his great contributions to theater and to the arts, and most importantly, to the work that he's doing right now at the Nate Holden Theater here in Los Angeles. Welcome.
Pat Prescott, I thank you so much for having me here and for including me in this honoring of the work that we're doing and that I'm doing. I adore you personally, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, congratulations, and we're proud of the work that you are doing, definitely. You know, recently I was at an event where you were doing an interview with Reginald Hudlin, which you did so beautifully. It was just, it was lovely. It was like sitting in the living room with two guys just having a conversation. It's something you do so well and so naturally, one of the many things. But I was sitting there in the audience and I was thinking, somebody needs to interview Ren because he's got one heck of a story too. And it does begin right here in Southern California. Let's talk a little bit about growing up and also about the great contributors who preceded you. When you were a little kid, what were you like then? And what was life like for you?
Well, firstly, growing up in Los Angeles always absolutely felt like home. My great-grandmother was born here in 1890. Her parents had married here in 1882, and so this is on my mother's line. And so having that rich history of your great-grandmother, your grandmother, and then your mother, and then your generation being born here, and our children now being born here, it just always felt like home. You know, I was from Los Angeles. A lot of people confuse Los Angeles with Hollywood. You know, Hollywood is an industry that functions in a major way in Los Angeles. But really, really, being an Angeleno means something very different than being from Hollywood, if you will. Rich experience. I have four brothers and one sister. Rich experience in our home, exposure to all of the finer things that this city has ever had to offer. You know, the transit system that is now coming back into Los Angeles was really, really rich when I was a child. I mean, to go to the Maralta Theater in Culver City, to go to all of the theaters in Hollywood, you know, to go to the theaters, the great theaters in downtown Los Angeles on Broadway. So the whole community where I grew up, basically at La Brea and Washington, we would all gather together, all the young people, and we would get on buses and go be entertained. We would go to Venice Beach. We would go to the skating rinks. So it was an extraordinarily rich experience growing up in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned that whole thing with the public transportation, how that brings everything right to your door, you know, and it's something I think that's really lacking now. It's a good thing that it is coming back. When you were growing up, I know that because you had people in your family before you who were involved in theater, I'm sure you were exposed to a lot of that too. Talk about your parents' involvement in getting you out to see things that, like, I know for us growing up, we went to a lot of stuff we didn't really want to go to.
We went to things
we were dragged along.
No, but Pat,
we
went to things that we absolutely adored going to. My father was a jazz musician. He had been a child actor, and so the arts were firmly in my household daily, absolutely daily. My mother's mother was a torch singer and a cotton club dancer. My father's mother was a cotton club dancer in New York. My father's father, Troy Brown Sr., was the fifth black actor in Screen Actors Guild. He was born March 17th, 1900 in Memphis, Tennessee. My mother's father, my living hero, my grandfather, Lee Young Sr., he was born in Louisiana, in New Orleans, on March 7th, 1914. He was the first black staff musician in the history of Hollywood. He was on the staff at Columbia Pictures in 1946, and for 25 years, he was the musical director for Nat King Cole. So his father, also Willis Handy Young, now my great-grandfather, Willis Handy Young was a musician who could take a job on 19 different instruments. He taught all of his children to play, and he was a band leader. Also, he had his own theatrical troupe. group. He had the New Orleans Strutters right at the turn of the 20th century. So the legacy of the arts in my bloodstream and in my family is fairly rich.
So as a child, when did you actually become interested in the theater? Did you, was that something that happened early on or later?
Well, my sixth grade teacher was the individual who absolutely walked me into my purpose. Mrs. Aladine Markham at Alta Loma Elementary School here in Los Angeles, she gave me Wordsworth, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, Langston Hughes, Gwendolyn Brooks, James Baldwin. She gave me Shelley and Donne. So she really, really walked me into my purpose in terms of one who loves language and great imagery. She taught us to square dance. She taught us a lot of folk dances. So my sister, from the time I was 5 years old, I always felt that I had a calling on my life, Pat, to be a communicator. I didn't know whether or not it would be ministerial, broadcast, journalistic, or as an actor. But at 5 years old, there was seemed to be a distinction on my ability to communicate with people. And my sister, my lone sister, Wilda Brown, she encouraged that in me. And so my first professional job was in sixth grade. I did a commercial for Funny Face, which was like the Kool-Aid of the day.
You remember doing that?
Oh, absolutely. I remember having to get my work permit downtown Los Angeles. I remember Mrs. Markham having to sign my work permit and my father taking me out to Burbank, California to a Catholic school where we shot this commercial.
And so I guess it was love at first try, huh?
Absolutely. It really, really was. But I became an athlete and, you know, young boys with brothers and certainly the neighborhood where I grew up. I was an athlete for many years, all of the traditional sports, but I was a tennis player most particularly.
Okay.
But it came back. It was always tugging on me. And at 17 years old at Hamilton High School here in Los Angeles, I was given a piece called The Antebellum Sermon by Paul Laurence Dunbar, the great poet from Dayton, Ohio. And Mr. Robert Jurkowski at Hamilton High School gave me this piece to perform in front of an audience one night in an evening we were presenting at school. And the way that piece began to touch me as I was performing it, and the way the audience responded, they fed me and I was attempting to feed them. And right in that moment, I said, I'm going to pay the kind of dues necessary to have a career in this industry as a performing artist. And that was the real inciting incident, if you will.
So what do you do then? All right, you're in high school now and you've made this decision. How did you start to act on that?
Well, I was doing the plays there at Hamilton High School. But one day there was a gentleman named Bob Preston. Bob Preston was the young adults or the youth division leader at the William Cunningham Commercial Agency. Mm-hmm. And he came to our school and was in the auditorium there at Hamilton. And I wasn't on stage presently. We were doing Oklahoma and I was playing Judd Fry. So I wasn't rehearsing. And so I welcomed him to the theater because he was a fresh face. And I said, good afternoon. How are you?
And he said, and you have good home training.
I thank you. I thank you. And so he said, I'm fine. I'm Bob Preston. I said, I'm Ren Brown. I said, welcome. I hope you enjoy our rehearsal. So the next day, Dr. William Tiefert, our great music teacher there at Hamilton, said to me, Ren, did you meet a gentleman named Bob Preston yesterday? And I said, yes. He said, well, he's from the William Cunningham Agency, and he'd like to meet you, to represent you. And they were on Robertson Boulevard here in Los Angeles as well. So I went down to William Cunningham's agency, basically at Robertson and Olympic, and I started reading the material that Bob Preston's assistant, Dinah, gave me to read. And I was just kind of reading it, and Bob Preston walked in and said, Dinah, did you coach Ren at all on what he's reading? And she said, no. He said, okay, we're going to sign him. And within 2 weeks, I got the first ever national Chicken McNuggets campaign.
Wow.
In March of 1982.
All right, so then what happened?
You know, I started going immediately. I went to the Inner City Cultural Center, mm-hmm, at 1308 South New Hampshire, as New Hampshire and Pico, one block west of Vermont at Pico Boulevard. There, the Inner City Cultural Center was founded in 1965. It was a phoenix that rose out of the ashes of the Watts riots. And C. Bernard Jackson and Dr. Alfred Cannon had founded this first intentional multicultural performing arts center with all of the disciplines, theater, voice, dance, all of the disciplines were offered there. And so I went there immediately. I would ride the number 12 bus on Washington Boulevard going east down Washington. I would get off at Vermont, walk up the hill and go to the Inner City Cultural Center. The first play I did was a play that Chip Fields, the mother of Kim Fields, had written a musical. It was called In Command of the Children. Kim Fields was in the show. Lisa Welcher, who was also a part of her cast on the show that she was doing at the time, Malcolm Jamal Warner, Teresa Randall, Sean Earle, several other personalities. I mentioned Shawnese Wilson, got a standing ovation every single night she would sing in that show. But on December 25th, 1982, the LA Times wrote a review on In Command of the Children, and it was the first professional review I had ever gotten, and it was very favorable and very encouraging. But there at the Inner City Cultural Center, was Rosalind Cash, Bea Richards, Paul Winfield, Lawrence Hilton Jacobs, and many others. And Lawrence Hilton Jacobs used to come over and watch our show. And he was so encouraging of me as a young developing artist. And this young man who had been starred in, of course, Cooley High and Welcome Back Cotter and so many things, his encouragement of me was hugely significant. And so that's kind of how it all began.
Yeah, and I'm sure that you in turn have taken on the mantle of encouragement for so many other young people. When somebody does that for you, it really kind of spurs you on, especially as you get older and you start to understand how important those moments like those are when someone says, yes, you can do this and kind of believes in you a little bit.
It's vitally important. And the notion of each one teach one is greatly important. And I have always felt, I've always been a generous person. I've never hoarded what I've had ever in any aspect of who I am. But particularly with this knowledge that I've gained through the 37 years of being a professional in this industry, I give it away freely. If someone comes to me respectfully and really wants to engage, I will take calls from people who are ostensibly ranked strangers and give it to them because it's necessary, because you do need guidance in this industry. Because when you come to Hollywood, if you don't come with a sense of self-definition, Hollywood will perhaps define you for you, and that does not always look good or feel good. And so I think it's vitally important to have mentors and people who are encouraging of you outside of the industry specific, so that you will go into this industry with a sense of balance so that you can navigate it.
Yeah, I think that's important too. Your work at the Inner City Cultural Center, I'm sure, provided a great foundation for you. As you moved on from there, did you decide to go to college?
Started at LA City College here, mm-hmm. and I was there performing and being trained under Howard Penn, for voice and articulation in the theater. And so that began that journey. I eventually went over to Antioch as well, but the work always was in front of me. I was always working. There was a wonderful program down at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. Miss Dorothy Freeze, who is the grandmother of Helen Hunt, she was a teacher of mine. Paul Gleason. So a part of that apparatus down there at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, where we were trained down there. And so it always became training and work. I was always attempting to do a play during the time where I had begun at LA City College. It was always vitally important for me to do a play, to get a guest star, a co-star on a TV show, but to do a play most particularly, to gain the experience of working on the boards.
Yeah. Now, coming from the kind of family that you came from, with the kind of talent that was in your family and people with the expertise that they had in performing, I was wondering, were your family members really difficult judges of you? I mean, were you, what kind of critique did you get from the people who had gone before you? Because it's a different situation for most people who enter into performing, who want to be an actor or whatever. Your family is supportive and they come to everything, but they may not really understand everything that you're doing. You had a unique situation in that your parents and grandparents all kind of knew what it was you were doing.
I was greatly encouraged. My mother's mother, particularly, who was so very close and lived in our home for an extended period, my grandmother, Mrs. Ruth Gibbons, she was a tremendous encourager of me and also had a standard in the way that she presented herself and the way that she would discuss the history of her art and the artists and peers that she had come along with. My father was the most creative man I ever met in my life. And my father was also one who was greatly encouraging, but he would absolutely encourage and to maintain a certain standard and to strive for a certain standard. My grandfather, my living hero, my Grandpa Lee was not only a great encourager, but he was the one who would really put down the critical critique. He was the one who wanted you to grow through the critique he would offer. And I can remember when I first appeared on television at Willoughby and La Brea at KCOP Channel 13, when I was a sixth grader, he really liked the folk dancing that I was doing. And he said, son, I have one note for you. When I was 12 years old, he said, never look down. Because sometimes, you're going through and you may not be so secure about a step. And so you kind of look down, trying to gauge where the step is with somebody else. He said, son, never look down. Now, this is a man who had been trained as a tap dancer by one of the greatest tap dancers in the history of the idiom, Jack Ginger Wiggins, who had also taught the Nicholas Brothers. So he had some great specific awareness of what he was talking about. I remember very specifically doing a play called Jeffrey's Plan in around 2000. And my grandfather came, and he came to opening night, and he really, really loved the work that I was doing. But he felt that I had made an entrance, and the energy and the volume was too high. And he said, I want you to consider calibrating your entrance differently so you absolutely have somewhere to go. So that's the kind of man he was. And vitally important in the growth of my life and my growth as an artist.
Yeah, really special that you had that. I mean, you know, just to be able to get that kind of direction. I mean, I believe that the critique is just as important as the encouragement, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the critique is about growth. It's not criticizing, which is to tear down, but it's a critique. And so it really brings about a suggestion or to raise another question or to create another perspective in such a way that you might grow from that. Or add something to yourself. So the critique is vitally important. I think it, in fact, may be equally, if not greater, in its importance to the encouragement.
Yeah, and I like to, you know, to call it notes. Notes sounds better.
Yes, absolutely.
Than criticism. And, you know, the thing is, when you know someone is on your side and loves and cares about you, it is so much easier to hear those things. And also, when you're hearing it from someone who actually comes from a point of authority, who has shown you before what they've done. And I would imagine that having had all of those talented people precede you, that has been something that has got to spur you on in your life, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It has been. I've stood on their shoulders. We hear that phrase a lot. But I really have stood on the shoulders of my family members who have come through these arts. I've been undergirded in such a beautiful way because they came through times that were malignant with regard to race in this country. I mean, we're talking about people, my great-grandfather being born in Thibodaux, Louisiana in 1872, the things that he must have seen. My grandparents all being born before 1915 in America, in the South, and certainly my grandmother here in Los Angeles. But the things that they endured, the kinds of indignities that they came through, it certainly suggested to me that if I held a standard and caused my work to continue to grow through honoring a standard, that I could certainly push through because they had come through times that were much more difficult than the times I was living in.
Exactly. That's a real thing right there. And you've done a lot. I mean, you've done commercials, you've done television, you've done film, you've done theater. Where's your heart really lie? What do you love the most?
You know, Pat, I love communicating as an actor in all of those mediums because they all have a different kind of response for you. I remember when I did a guest lead on Different World in 1989, and it was amazing because it aired on the night it aired, and then I walked into the Beverly Center next day, and 35 people walked up having seen it. So there's something about the immediacy of that that's like it titillates you, but also it's a little scary. But the work, I have to be honest with you, the work of the theater, when you look at someone and you try to speak truth to their eyes and have that truth come back, when you listen and you respond and you allow yourself to be affected, you allow yourself to be vulnerable. And I mean vulnerable from a perspective of being accessible, not vulnerability as in weakness, but an accessibility born of your vulnerability. But the theater is kind of a majestic sensation happens on the boards.
And one of the great things about theater, too, is just you're part of a community. The audience is a huge part of that. And that's what makes it interesting and makes it different every night, because every audience, whether they realize it or not, they have to bring something to the table, too, that manifests itself in what happens in that communication that night.
Audience is vitally important. But at the end of the day, when you're on the stage, you have to take the finest focus that you've ever encountered. You have to focus. You really, really have to concentrate on the stage. I mean, you have to concentrate if you're acting in film, television, theater, or commercials, but there's nothing like focusing and concentrating on the stage because you don't get a second take.
Yeah, you really don't. I think that it's incredible that you have done the work that you're doing here at Nate Holden. Let's talk a little bit about how that situation came to pass and also just about what that means for continuing your family's legacy.
The Ebony Repertory Theater at the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center lives at the center of my heart. The Nate Holden Performing Arts Center is what I call theatrical terra firma. From 1924, that soil has held a theater. In 1924, it was called the Rempaugh Theater. It was a 750-seat single-screen Art Deco movie house. It then became something called Jazz at the Metro. And in 1966, Mr. Nick Stewart, who had played Lightning on Amos and Andy, and his wife, Mrs. Edna Stewart, they brought their company, which had been founded in 1950, called the Ebony Showcase Theater. They purchased that property in 1966, and that's where they established their home. So that was 150 yards from the front door where I was born and raised. So in walking past the Ebony Showcase Theater, where the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center now sits, that was the first time I had seen a marquee. I was walking with my three older brothers and my sister, and I said to my sister, "What is that?" And she said, "That's a marquee." And so years later, when it came time to found my company that would be the resident company and operator of the Nate Holden Performing Arts Center, I thought about naming the company the Apex Repertory Theater, because the Apex Club had been on Central Avenue before it became the Club Alabama, and all four of my grandparents had played the Apex. So I said, maybe an homage to them, the Apex Repertory Theater. In fact, I had some designs done for the logo. But then I said, "Ren, what touched you first?" And I remembered the first marquee I'd ever seen. And so the company then became the Ebony Repertory Theater in honor of the first marquee I ever saw.
One of the really cool things about where you work is that amazing building. Talk about that a little bit. I think it's too long been one of LA's best kept secrets, though the secret is getting out, which is a good thing.
You know, the secret is getting out. The Nate Holden Performing Arts Center was built by the Community Redevelopment Agency. Nate Holden brought together federal, state, and local monies to ensure that that theater would be built. It is an absolutely gorgeous facility. The theater chamber itself has 400 seats, and people consider it one of the finest mid-sized houses in Los Angeles, California. It's a facility and a stage and a theater that holds dance beautifully, theater beautifully, lecture, as well as music. And so it's so highly functional from that perspective. But being there, Pat, in a role of cultural leadership, 150 yards from the front door where I was born, to return in a role of cultural leadership where we are putting art on the stage, where the community is able to see itself as whole, means the world to me. It really, really means the world to me.
And it really means the world to the community, too. Talk about some of the great productions that you've had and some of the accomplishments that you're most proud of in the role that you have today.
Well, we've had several award-winning productions. We gave Felicia Rashad her directorial debut here in Los Angeles with our production of A Raisin in the Sun. We just had a sensational production of Five Guys Named Mo, starring the Emmy Award winner Oba Babatunde. We had the great Paul Robeson show played a solo play done by the two-time Emmy Award winning Keith David. We launched ourselves with Two Trains Running by August Wilson, with the Emmy Award winner Glenn Turman in the lead and the late Tony Award winner Roger Robinson playing in the show as well. So we've had wonderful successes with Crowns and with Jeff Stetson's Fraternity. We've had some wonderful successes. Diane Reeves has been on our stage. Billy Childs has been on our stage. Mr. Ahmad Jamal has performed on our stage. We've had wonderful, wonderful personalities. The Garth Fagan Dance Company. Garth Fagan out of Rochester, New York, this extraordinary company. Garth Fagan choreographed The Lion King on the stages of the world. They come and they're a perennial company in residence with us from New York. So we've had a lot of victories in many ways there at the theater. And Israel Hicks, who was our founding artistic director, one of the most gifted and generous men I'd ever met in my life, we lost him in 2010. But Israel's spirit lives there at the Ebony Repertory Theater because we designed our future together. And we are working assiduously to implement that future now. And I'm hopeful that one of my children or one of the children of the community will take that theater over at some point soon.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned your children and your family. And I think it's kind of part of the secret to your success is that family unit and the family togetherness. And I want you to talk a little bit about your family and some of your other hopes for the future. And I know your wife, who is fantastic.
I agree.
Love her to pieces.
I agree, and she loves you to pieces.
And that means a lot, too, doesn't it, having somebody who supports you and understands what you're doing?
It means everything. For me, family is everything, and to have someone that you've begun the race with in life. We've been married 27 and a quarter years. We have three children. We have two daughters and a son. We've been so blessed. A lot of people fall down in life, Pat. We fall up. And it's not that life is without challenge, but we really, really have had a beautiful journey. And having Anne, who herself danced for many years with the Washington Ballet, she's a lawyer in this city, but she is really, really an arts-centric personality. Not only does she know how to support the arts, she really is an artist within her. She's an exquisite writer. She comes out of a background where the arts and literary works have been a part of her journey. So she understands it. And knowing that she understands what I do when I do it every single day, or on many of the days when you don't do it in an absolute objective way, but you're always working toward, she gets it and understands it, and it's been vitally important. I really believe, you know, my eldest daughter is a writer, and she's writing successfully in New York City. Our son just started college. He's in his second semester of college. But our youngest daughter, who just finished her third year of college last May, she's a senior this year. She's not in school right now. She wanted a little time off. But I think that Morgan Haley Brown, our youngest daughter, is the one who has the breadth of the sensibility, I feel, who could take over the theater and run it in deeply into the 21st century in a magnificent way.
This could be our fifth generation, couldn't it?
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right.
Because we got to keep this Brown thing going.
We got to keep this Brown thing going.
It is awesome. I tell you what, Wren, we are so proud of you, proud of your accomplishment. You're a good friend and just a wonderful person to have in our community. And for this reason and many, many more, we honor you this year during Black History Month as someone who is making waves in Southern California. We hope you will continue to do so.
You honor me to no end. I'm so appreciative. And I'm so encouraged, Pat, to be here with you today, because I really do adore Pat Prescott. But I also adore the work that you do into your fifth decade. And so I celebrate you. I thank you. I thank 94.7 The Wave for honoring me. I hope to see you soon.
You definitely will. Thank you so much, Ren.
Thank you.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.